In sports, Tiger Woods' extraordinary apology today is the first step toward healing the image of Tiger the man. But Tiger the pitchman still has a long way to go to recover the corporate goodwill he has squandered. Marketing experts say rebuilding Tiger Inc. will be possible only when he returns to the golf course. His apology left the timing of that in doubt, though he didn't rule out coming back this year. Public relations experts say Woods' statement had the essential ingredients: a sincere public apology, accountability for his behavior, and a prescription for how it would be remedied. Evan Lyshechek is ecstatic over his Olympic figure skating gold medal and says he'd love to be there for the 2014 Olympics in Russia. The Naperville native joked on NBC's Today Show this morning that he isn't sure if he's welcome in Russia after beating defending gold medalist Evgeny Plushenko last night. Patrick Kane and the rest of his U.S. hockey teammates will take a 2-0 Olympic record into Sunday's game with Canada. The Chicago Blackhawks star scored his first Olympic goal in yesterday's 6-1 win over Norway. The Chicago Bulls could have 4 new players in uniform when they take on the Minnesota Timberwolves tonight. The Bulls picked up Flip Murray, A.C. Law, Hakeem Warrick, and Joe Alexander in a pair of deals before the trading deadline yesterday. Illini basketball fans are debating the number of remaining regular season games the team will have to win to ensure a bid to the NCAA tournament in March. Some say 2 out of 5 is enough. Everyone agrees 3 is safer. Illini forward Mike Davis says the team is not setting its sights low.
We're still thinking about Big Ten Championship. We got to win this game Saturday first and foremost. But if we win, Purdue can knock off Michigan State or Ohio State can knock off Michigan State. Everybody have 4 losses. That's what we're shooting for. But other than that, you know, our goal is to go 5-0.
The Illini play 4th-ranked Purdue tomorrow afternoon at 3 Central Time in West Lafayette. Meanwhile, the Illini women fell on the road to the Spartans last night. The score 64-43. That's sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Technology Entrepreneur Center, hosting an invention-to-venture workshop for faculty and others interested in the process and practice of technology entrepreneurship this Saturday at the Coordinated Science Lab. More information is at inventiontoventure.org/urbana10 or 265-5456.
We had the opportunity to bring some inner-city youth out to the park and give them an opportunity to see things that the general public probably won't get to do in the park, but also what the general public can do. Kids that had never been out in a canoe or shot a gun or held a geese. It was a hands-on experience from them, and they went from being scared to being active participants.
I would say it made me look at what I was doing, like when I would just throw a chip bag out the car or a piece of gum to the grass, what it could do to the animals if they were to get a hold to it and how it could affect their lives.
WILL provided the overall management of the whole program. They were the push behind everybody. My name is John Hott, and I'm the site superintendent of Kickapoo State Park, and WILL is my source for great community partnership.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Now a story about a possible scam involving health savings accounts. Thousands of people are learning that money they squirreled away for health care expenses is gone. It appears to have been stolen. Federal investigators have released few details, but all the cases have one thing in common: a Chicago company called Canopy Financial. Here's NPR's Jeff Brady.
On a tree-lined street in Denver, Lon and Wendy Nestrud both work from home. They're in their 40s and self-employed. She's a musician. He's a software consultant. Conventional health insurance was too expensive, so they have a high-deductible plan for things like hospitalization and a health savings account for routine expenses. In December, Wendy was at the dentist for a regular cleaning. Afterward, she pulled out her health savings account debit card.
And when I went to pay, my card was declined.
Wendy knew there was enough money in the account, about $2,000.
It kind of set my heart racing. It's like, what?
The Nestruds called Shawnee Administrative Services, the company that managed their HSA. That's when they learned that another company that processed transactions for Shawnee was in trouble. Canopy Financial's co-founder had been arrested, and money was missing from HSA accounts. The Nestruds were given a toll-free number to call.
You've reached the Canopy Financial Health Savings Account Customer Information Hotline.
The message lists a bunch of companies that Canopy Financial processed transactions for. Then there's this.
Although all of the funds for these health savings accounts were supposed to be held in custodial bank accounts, a substantial amount of funds were misappropriated and are now missing. As a result, all of these accounts have been frozen.
Hiring a lawyer seemed prudent, but the Nestrudes figured that could easily cost them more than the $2,000 in their account. Lon found a Facebook group of others affected by the Canopy bankruptcy, but specifics in the case are still hard to come by.
We're now creditors in Canopy Financial's Chapter 7 bankruptcy filing. From my understanding, there's a lot of creditors and not enough money to cover all of that, so who knows how that's going to shake up.
No charges have been filed against Canopy executives related to the missing HSA money. Charges have been brought in a related investment fraud case. Co-founder Jeremy Blackburn is free on $1 million bail. His attorney says he won't talk to NPR. A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office says only that the investigation is continuing. Meantime, the Nestrudes are left wondering if they'll ever see their HSA money again. And they're not alone. Nearly 14,000 customers of Maryland-based Coventry Healthcare also are affected. An attorney for the company says $17 million is missing. Coventry has replaced that money for its customers and will try to recover as much as it can in the bankruptcy. This case has prompted some tough questions about HSAs. How could this money just disappear? Who was monitoring Canopy Financial? Some people are saying more government regulation is needed.
We set up a whole financial industry without the commensurate regulation.
Sarah Horowitz is executive director of the Freelancers Union. While her group didn't do business with Canopy, more than 80 of her members are asking for help.
And what we're seeing are all these people who are being affected. And that's, I think, really what we need to talk about here.
At the American Bankers Association, HSA advocates like Kevin McKechnie say it's too soon to be talking about new regulations. He says the criminal investigation needs to wrap up first. Still, McKechnie says a buyer beware campaign is in order.
We think we're going to come down to a phrase that may, in fact, fit on one of the disclosures or even on something more perhaps culturally relevant, like a T-shirt. And it's just this: know your trustee. If you're going to give money to somebody, who are you giving it to?
Back in Colorado, the Nestrudes say they've learned that lesson. When they sign up for their next health savings account, they'll more closely examine which companies are involved. And they say they'll probably feel more comfortable going with big companies they've heard of. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
One immediate change following former Governor Rod Blagojevich's removal from office last year was the overhaul of four state pension boards. Governor Pat Quinn signed legislation last spring that not only changed the membership of those boards, but moved the chair of Illinois' Board of Higher Education into the same role with the state university's retirement system. Kerry Heitman has served in both capacities since July. AM 580's Jeff Bossert spoke with her about that dual role and the funding challenges faced by colleges and universities.
Can you talk about the unique advantage you have? Do you specifically see one overseeing both?
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting, when I first learned of my additional role, I didn't know what to make of it initially. I mean, obviously there's a higher education connection between the two. What I would say is that I now know, after being in this role for several months, this newer role, that it was actually very smart of the legislature and the governor to combine the two into one person, because the pension obligation, the impact on the state budget is part of our budget at IBHE. So we always talked about it. We didn't get into details on it because we don't manage the investments and we don't manage the benefit side. But we know that we have to look at the number. It's part of our budget. And so there was always, we always looked at it. We always knew about it. And now it's sort of bringing the issues together, and there is just a synergy between the two. And the other thing that I'd say is, my day job is that I'm chief legal officer of a Fortune 300 company. And the time that I became chair of the state pension board was when the financial crisis hit. And learning what I learned being in a corporate role, where we were, significantly, our pension was significantly affected by the economy and by the drop in stock prices and everything that happened that we all know about, it gives me an additional perspective and better knowledge of how pension funds work and a better appreciation of external forces impacting pension funding, et cetera.
In the role with IBHE, that one thing that is, I think it was discussed this week, they were asked or talked about how some universities are interested in borrowing. I'm sure you're hearing different proposals on different campuses, but what do you think should take place?
I think desperate times require desperate measures. And while I wouldn't want to see any institution, incur an expense that's unnecessary, I think it's pretty difficult to say that it's unnecessary to keep the lights on. It's unnecessary to continue classes and pay your professors. And so, I can assure you that no institution of higher education is going to borrow money unless they need to. They don't want to do that. On the other hand, do we want to sit by and say, don't do it at all and just let the chips fall where they may? And I don't think that we want to. So this is not their preferred option, I can assure you of that. They're trying to figure out any way to make it through this difficult time.
Do you look over what other institutions are starting to do with furloughs, anything?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we're totally, linked into the discussions among all of the presidents and chancellors of the major, of all the state higher education institutions. Like I said, we don't, approve. They don't always come to us, advise us in advance, but we keep abreast of what's happening because it's so critical to the overall higher education mission in the state.
Carrie Heitman chairs both the Illinois Board of Higher Education and State University's retirement system. She spoke with AM 580's Jeff Bosser. As you listen to us on the radio or the computer, there's a good chance you're burning coal. It's a source of energy that's been used for hundreds of years. A Macomb-based activist and writer says it's now long past time for us to find a new power source. Rich Egger reports.
Illinois has a lengthy association with the coal industry. It's a dirty story, as told in the book Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland. The author is Jeff Biggers. He feels Illinois has emerged as ground zero in the climate debate.
Because, of course, here's where coal was discovered in the 1600s. And here, what's really so much of our national policy was based on 200 years ago. And the same ideas, the same notions that regulated the coal industry 200 years ago, that commerce and profits for outside coal companies are more important than the common good of the people and the land, ultimately resonate today. Not only from the horrific realities of strip mining, but to the destructive practice of longwall mining, which is a new type of mining we're doing that's destroying the fertile farm areas of central Illinois, to ultimately the burning and the storage of coal ash. Chicago, of course, has some of the dirtiest coal fire plants in the nation, some of the worst mercury emissions in the nation. And, of course, the final battle that's really having to deal with climate destabilization is whether or not our country is going to buy into this new bridge to nowhere, which is, of course, FutureGen and the carbon capture and storage project that's slated now for Mattoon.
Yeah, you make it pretty clear in the book that you don't believe in the FutureGen project. Why?
FutureGen is really one of the great shams, I think, being put on the American taxpayers. No scientist can come onto your program and tell you that we actually have the science and the technology to capture carbon emissions and store them in the ground safely within the next 10 or even 20 years. It's still completely in the baby stages. And all of the government reports tell us that it's something we're still trying to figure out. When President Obama created his Clean Coal Task Force just a couple of weeks ago, I think he made a colossal error because ultimately he locked us in to billions upon billions of tax dollars from Americans that will go to something that ultimately is not going to pan out. It's too late and too little.
I imagine you use electricity in your day-to-day life, so you're burning coal a little bit too. How do you get past that?
That's a great point. We are all part of the problem. We all live in the coal fields now. Every time you flick on your light or flick on your computer, you're ultimately detonating an explosion in the coal field. You're destroying someone's life. You're destroying a mountain in Appalachia. You're destroying the fertile farm fields of central Illinois. And ultimately, you're allowing so much mercury and carbon dioxide emissions to emit into our children's future. And so you're right. We all need to be responsible now and move our country forward to a clean energy future. I'm part of a new movement called the Coal Free Future Project. And we feel that until we have an administration and politicians who definitively say, hey, we have to have a coal-free future, that we have to have a roadmap to get off coal, that we're never going to advance to a true clean energy future. You know, I think we know we're not going to end coal mining tomorrow. It provides 45% of our electricity nationwide. But until we have a roadmap to get off coal, we're going to continue to be blindsided by the coal industry and really continue this really devastating industry. The costs just don't outweigh the benefits anymore.
The title of the book is Reckoning at Eagle Creek. Can you tell us a little bit about Eagle Creek, what it was like in the past and what you see there today?
You know, Eagle Creek was one of the first historic communities in Illinois. My relatives went in there before 1805, most likely prior to that, as missionaries but also squatters.
And this is in southern Illinois.
This is at the very southeastern tip of southern Illinois, just 20 miles from the river across from Kentucky and very near Shawneetown in Indiana. This little area is phenomenal because the Wisconsin glaciers didn't reach this part of southern Illinois. And so you have an incredible diversity of flora and fauna, 1,100 species. You know, we have our own mountain, our own card-carrying mountain in this area. And that's where my family lived for 200 years. It's really one of the first areas that was designated a wilderness site in Illinois. But there was one problem. Our little holler where we grew up, where my family had lived for 200 years, had resource attributes. It had coal. And so there was a little loophole in the regulations that allowed them to strip mine this historic community. Now, what they strip mined, though, was not literally the beautiful land and our farm. They strip mined the history there. We found out, in fact, that it had been inhabited for thousands of years because we have the great salt wells there. That, in fact, this area had been a place of legal slavery and that we actually had a black cemetery on our family's property that was strip mined. Because what most people don't realize is that the coal industry was part and parcel of the salt industry in the early period. And Illinois, when we created our Constitution, we said there's no slavery in Illinois except for this tiny little loophole. You know, our salt wells, which were generated by coal mines. And it was my people, once again, that fought the slavery in Illinois to make that emancipation a reality for everyone. And so this part of Eagle Creek, to me, is rich not only in heritage but also as a cautionary tale for today's experience in what we're dealing with mining.
Author Jeff Bigger says there is no such thing as clean coal. He says it's just a marketing phrase. Biggers believes energy should come from a variety of sources, and he says a weatherization program could create jobs while reducing energy consumption. Rich Egger reporting.
Earth and Sky.
We have a good momentum in Brazil right now to stop deforestation in the Amazon forever.
You're listening to Brazilian biologist Paulo Muccino. He recently co-authored a study with the U.S.-based Woods Hole Research Center. The study identified strategies for ending deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. Muccino said that since 2004, Brazil has reduced deforestation by 64%.
We have a society more